From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from Cincinnati Public Radio in Ohio. It's Here and Now. The Labor Department said today that the U.S. added 164,000 jobs in July. That's about what economists were expecting. But those numbers did not seem to inspire the stock market, which is still reacting to President Trump's announcement yesterday that he's planning more tariffs on Chinese goods come September. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with that jobs report. Another strong month of job growth. What's your takeaway?
Yeah, yeah. On the surface, it looked pretty good. Arguably, there is some softness when you get into the details. For one thing, the prior 2 months were revised lower. So in May and June, actually saw 41,000 fewer jobs added than we previously thought. And also, if you look at the trend over, say, the average of 3 months or 6 months, it's trending downward. It's below that sort of 200,000 level that's been the average since the recovery really got started in 2010. And one really sort of underappreciated statistic in this that economist Carl Riccadonna pointed out to me is that the average number of hours worked per week actually slipped a little bit to 34.3. And that's a 2-year low. And it might not sound like a bad thing. People are working less hours per week. But, you know, if you're getting paid by the hour, that means you're earning less money. So the way he calculated it, he says that's like removing 200,000 jobs from the economy. So basically offsetting the gains we saw this month.
Well, what about wage growth? What did we see there?
3.2%, decent, a little bit above what was expected.
Mike, as the Fed looks at this, and they just this week decided to cut interest rates for the first time since the financial crisis, cutting interest rates is something the Fed typically does when it's worried about growth. So as they look at this jobs report, which, you know, as you say, it's been trending down, but it's still pretty good job growth. What do they see?
You know, I don't think this alone in isolation will move the needle for them too much. They likely will take note of the sort of softer elements that I've noticed, but it's still a decent report. It's not ringing major alarm bells for them. They're more looking at some of the other, and especially global economic data, particularly in the manufacturing sector in Europe and even in the U.S. Some of the ISM reports coming out show that growth in manufacturing is really ground to a halt. So those are the things they're trying to sort of get ahead of, because they could eventually lead the job market and affect the job market a little further down the line.
What about the tariffs? The stock market fell sharply yesterday when President Trump surprised some people and announced that he will put 10% tariffs on an additional $300 billion worth of Chinese goods starting in September. This includes things like smartphones and sneakers, which until now have been spared from the tariffs. Why is he doing this?
Well, it's clear even from the president's tweets at the beginning of the week and further reporting by Bloomberg and others since then that the trade delegation, basically Steve Mnuchin and Robert Lighthizer, were in Shanghai this week. It's clear that there wasn't much progress made, and they didn't really come back with anything to make Trump think that the two sides were getting closer together. So he's really using this apparently as a way to ratchet up pressure on China before the next round of talks in the U.S. in September.
Now, that may look like it's a good negotiating tactic. However, as we've reported, there are a lot of other countries in Asia that are benefiting from this trade war, and China is simply cutting the tariffs on them and doing more trade with them. Is the U.S. losing out every time the pressure gets ratcheted up?
Right. And there is they're doing more business with Russia on the agriculture side, too. President Trump looks at it the way most economists don't look at it. He believes if China is struggling a little bit, that that's good for America. Most people, I think most economists would not agree with that. Economics is a global issue. If China's struggling, it's not necessarily to our benefit. But, you know, clearly President Trump has his own way of looking at the world.
Well, and is China responding directly to the tariffs that President Trump just announced yesterday?
We haven't, you know, there was a state media, the Global Times, one of the Chinese state newspapers, had an editorial basically saying this is just pushing them further apart. We're kind of waiting to see if they will announce a sort of big retaliation for this.
That is Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Okay, let's jump into our weekly social media roundup with Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Peter.
Let's start with politics and the Democratic debates in Detroit this week. I don't know if you were watching, but the very final moments of the evening, the candidates were giving their closing arguments and asking supporters to go to their websites to donate. Here's how Joe Biden did it.
If you agree with me, go to Joe30330 and help me in this fight. Thank you very much.
I mean, that was kind of a head-scratcher because it's not a website, but guess what? It is now.
Yeah, it's a website now. Joe Biden sounded a little confused. Everybody else was a little bit confused, jumped online to see what there was, and there was nothing initially, but now there are at least half a dozen Joe30330 Twitter accounts. They are parody accounts. This is one that I picked up just as I was waiting to go on the air. I'm from I'm running for who cares? I'm friends with Barack Obama and I'm winning. And the first tweet is, did I win yet? This is not, need I say, a proper Joe Biden campaign account. People were very quick on the uptake. They actually brought the domain. So there are a couple of domains out there that are pretty much similar to Joe30330. One will take you to a marketing website, very savvy. They say, don't do what Joe Biden did. We will market for you properly. Another one takes you to a Syracuse University student. These happened within moments of the debate. What was Joe Biden trying to say? What he was trying to say, text, and then text his campaign number.
Course.
Lots of teasing memes, making fun of Joe Biden being somewhat clueless. But he pretty much had the last laugh because now everybody knows the text. And there's an uptick on people actually following him and finding out more about his campaign.
You know,
it all ended well.
Yeah, and
for
know what this reminds me of? It's like, you know, for better or worse, anytime you make a mistake in public, watch out.
And it blows up.
Yeah.
But definitely more publicity than if he got it right and he was super slick and he said text the number.
All right. So let's move on to this story. In Hawaii, Native Hawaiians protesting a telescope project on the summit of Mauna Kea on Wednesday. The Rock, the actor Dwayne Johnson, who grew up in Hawaii, spoke on The Tonight Show about visiting those protesters.
This is so much bigger than a telescope being built. This is humanity. These are human beings whose hearts are hurting.
And we've talked about these protests on the show. They've been going on for a while. It's been an ongoing battle. But why is this back in the news? Yeah.
Back in the news because it's a giant telescope on Mauna Kea, which is considered by Native Hawaiians to be incredibly sacred. So the idea that you would put more construction on this very sacred site, this is what is getting Native Hawaiians out there to protest. Construction was due to start, and the protesters, or the protectors, as they call themselves, protectors of Mother Earth, stood in the way. They have an encampment that's in the way of the only road that will go up to the construction site, and they're now getting more publicity than ever, possibly because of social media amplifying their message. IKEA Movement, for instance, says, we recognise that the struggle for Mauna Kea is a struggle for land, for resources, for that which is sacred. And then the celebrity endorsements and support coming. Bruno Mars on Instagram was saying, Bruno Mars the singer, I love you, Hawaii. I am with you. Hashtag protect Mauna Kea. Jason Momoa, who is also Hawaiian, he was at the camp. He was taking pictures, supporting everybody. Who else? Damian Marley was there. The Rock, Jack Johnson. So a lot of publicity, high-profile support. Also because when you look at it on social media, this mountain is beautiful to look at. The elders are wearing their native Hawaiian outfits. It's very striking and it's very heartfelt and passionate and sacred. So this is all the ingredients of a campaign that really can grow and become more international and get outside of the US and around the world. And celebrities are now seeing it and putting their support behind it. And as for the construction, the deadline has been moved back 2 years.
And speaking of celebrities, here's another story. Entertainment host Mario Lopez is apologizing this week after something that he said on the Candace Owens show on YouTube back in June. He's criticizing parents who let their children pick their gender at a young age.
My God, if you're 3 years old and you're saying you're feeling a certain way, or you think you're a boy or a girl, whatever the case may be, I just think it's dangerous as a parent to make that determination then. Okay.
Okay, Femi, Mario yes. Lopez has backtracked on this after some social media backlash, but there, you know, lots of support for what he's saying too.
People were criticizing him apologizing. That almost never happens. Hashtag I stand with Mario Lopez. Robert N. Wilson III, for instance, says 3-year-old kids want to put their hands on the stove. They want to walk out in the middle of the street. They want to eat ice cream, soda and candy bars for lunch every day. So how can a 3-year-old kid determine if it wants to be male or female? This is the debate that's been going on about trans children for some time, and there is no there's no consensus as to whether Mario Lopez was wrong or right, mm-hmm. but maybe he should not have apologized, and this conversation continues to go on online and offline, of course.
Sounds like he touched a nerve.
Definitely.
Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome, Peter. Take care.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
This week's Democratic debates didn't offer many hints about who will be the face of the party next year. In fact, it highlighted how far the Democrats are from deciding what their pitch will be to voters and who will make it. But on the Republican side, it was clear at President Trump's campaign rally last night in Cincinnati that the general election is already underway. I hadn't been to a Trump rally since 2016, right before he won the South Carolina primary and long before he had the nomination wrapped up. Back then, voters were drawn to his message with the hope that he could deliver for them. Last night, I arrived at an arena with lines snaking around the block full of adoring supporters who trust President Trump completely and are already energized to reelect him. Dolores Scardini and Barbara Bergdahl saw our microphones and came right over.
We love Trump.
And we love Democrats, but we just think they
no,
are...
I don't love Democrats.
No. I mean, I have Democrat friends. No. But as far as the politicians, no. No.
Tell me, what do you love about Trump?
He's for us, everybody in America, yeah. And even other people. They want to come here to be legal and to be legally. Not just come.
I like Trump because he's hardcore. He talks like I'm talking to you now. You know, he's rough around the edges, and that's what I am. I'm rough around the edges, and whatever comes to my mind, I just say whatever comes to my mind. He may not be real swagger like Obama, but that was a lot of bull.
What do you mean real swagger?
You know, like he had the way of talking to people. Obama, you know, he could convince you that everything was just great, but everything wasn't, because my son-in-law owned a business and we almost went under.
I mean, no jobs. People on NPR should watch Fox News because they are not fake.
So I just feel like Trump's more, he's a businessman, he's getting things done. People have money in their pocket. And that's something they weren't used to for a really, really long time. I mean, 8 years, people were going down the toilet. So I'm for Trump. He's done a lot of things that they don't even publish, you know, so.
What about some of the things that offend people that he's been saying over the last few weeks? Does that bother you at all?
About racist?
Baltimore, about, yeah,
well,
race.
You know, he's the kind of guy, he's a street fighter. So if you punch him or you get close to people that he loves, then he's going to fight back. And that's what I like about him, because if you say something about my family, I'm gonna come after you. I'm 4'11", but I will definitely do something serious.
But what did somebody say about his family?
About his tweets and, you know, racist. I don't think the man is racist at all. It's just that the people that he's going against are a different color than you and I are. So that makes him racist because he said it about them. But I don't think he's racist at all. I really don't. I've never thought that.
I asked Ronnie Gilbert about those Baltimore tweets as well, and here's what he said.
The man is trying to do good for America, and everybody's just kind of throwing shade at him because they think he's a racist or a Nazi or whatever the case may be.
And you don't think so?
No, not at all.
What about the attacks on Baltimore and other things that have happened over the last week? You don't think those are...
I mean, kind of if the shoe fits, you know what I mean? Like, you can't take it for, okay, Baltimore has this amount of many black people, so it's racist. It has to be looked at. He's given Eliza Cummings District $16 billion this year, and where's it going? Like, what's it going to? If it's still terrible, then what's the money going to?
One of the first things you notice at a Trump rally is that nearly everyone in attendance is white. In a crowd of tens of thousands, I saw a few dozen non-white people. One of them was Alicia Kemp, who arrived with two of her kids.
I have been immigrated from the Philippines since I was six, and so I became a citizen the legal way. And I have kids that are going to school here, and we pay taxes, and I don't want to pay taxes for things that, I don't think I should have to. So that's why I'm here.
And most of the people in this line are white.
Yes.
You're not.
We're halfway.
I'm a conservative, so I'm fiscally responsible. I'm conservative in our social values. We're Catholic.
But why do you think that is, that there are not more people of color on this line?
People are afraid. I mean, a lot of people didn't go because they didn't want to mess with the line, or they were afraid about being hurt while we were here, because a lot of people were saying, please be careful, Mom, or please be careful, we don't want anybody, you know, because you don't know what the people who don't think properly are going to act like, because a lot of people get immature when they come to these rallies. As a non-white person, you already have a lot of things to contend with, and you're judged more quickly than those who are around you, so you're going to be extra careful about your actions and what you say.
4 more years! 4 more years!
The line to get into the rally at this point, 2 hours before the event, is going around the side of the nearly 18,000-seat U.S. Bank Arena, and then back again. Almost everyone in line is wearing a Trump T-shirt of some kind, or one that says the Democrat Party is the enemy of the people, or if this is what winning looks like, another 4 years of Trump will kill us, lol. It actually says LOL on the shirt. Or stand for the flag, kneel for the cross. Or in the case of Eric Stoibel, collusion delusion.
Yeah, awesome. That's great, isn't it?
What made you decide to get that shirt?
Because I think it's a false narrative all the way through. They haven't been able to prove anything. There's so many reasons why it's false. You know, I can't think of all that's on my mind about it, because it just really pisses me off. But Trump's been right all along, and he's proven it every time he's gone out there. Now the courts are starting to prove it. Now the AG's going to find out what's going on. I mean, they said Comey didn't have to go to jail. They figured out that he wasn't guilty or whatever he did as far as to give that information to that professor. But anyway, I think right now that Trump's on a roll. And this is just the beginning. I think if they start going through and they find out all the things that he has done that we're claiming to by CNN, NBC, we can't believe any of them. I mean, I'm my own man. I don't listen to Trump. I see this stuff myself.
Where do you get your news from?
I watch Fox. I also, AOL, MSNBC on a website, so I'll watch some of that. But mostly I'll get it from Fox. I trust them. I mean, they say bad things about Trump here and there, but they also say good things. So, you know, I need to, you know, they're about the only news people I can trust that'll go back and say both good and bad for Trump.
Many of the people I spoke with mentioned Fox News when asked where they get their news. But if you look closely, you'll see that some are wearing T-shirts or hats or little pins that have the letter Q on them, as in QAnon, the conspiracy theory that claims a deep state plot against President Trump and his supporters, among other things.
Tell me about your shirt.
What about my shirt?
It's got a Q on it.
Yeah, it's QAnon. Yeah.
QAnon. So what is it that's attracted you to QAnon?
The fact that it's exposed government corruption and what they're doing behind closed doors and Americans don't even know about it. Yeah.
Such as?
Iran nuclear deal, which gave $150 billion to the Iran mullahs, and $1.8 billion. Numerous different things with Jeffrey Epstein that have been pointed out way before it was even, it was back in 2008 and probably before that, but, in my opinion, I believe it's real, but
everybody's got their own opinion.
Yeah, what made you trust in QAnon?
What do you mean, trust?
I mean, why do you believe all of those things that you just said?
Because it provides factual evidence. I mean, you can research, if you actually dig it close enough, I mean, you can find factual evidence on the United States government websites, like the Department of Justice and other things that Q points to and other things of that nature.
Did you vote for President Trump?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what attracted you to him in the first place?
He's pro-America. I mean, I was in the United States Army for 3 years. I was in the infantry, been all over the world, and to see how... I mean, I spoke to numerous people from Thailand and the Thai Royal Army and, let's see, and the South Korean Army. And, I mean, not too many of them. I mean, they love America, but some of the leadership that they have, like, I don't know. But
what was the biggest moment for you in that rally just now? What was the moment when you were most happy about what you were hearing?
I mean, just him laying out facts of what he's done to make America great, obviously. I mean, the number one economy in the world, and for a while, well, I mean, it's the best it's ever been for a long time. But, I mean, other than that, I mean, that's really it.
Can I just get your name?
Huh?
Can I just get your name?
For what purpose?
For our broadcast.
I mean, my first name's Jared, but that's about as much as you're going to get.
Okay. Thank you, Jared.
Yeah, appreciate it. Have a good night.
The president made no mention of QAnon in his speech, which went on for an hour and 20 minutes and touched on everything from the coal industry to the pronunciation of Lima, Ohio. But the crowd was electrified by his words, which were very much on message 15 months ahead of the election. Promises made, promises kept, conservative judges on the federal courts, a roaring economy. He said multiple times Ohio had the best economy it's ever had. But whatever brought voters to this rally, the president used it to unite them against his eventual opponent, who he is already branding.
No matter what label they use, a vote for any Democrat in 2020 is a vote for the rise of radical socialism and the destruction of our great, our beautiful, our wonderful American dream. We're not going to let our country ever go down the route of socialism.
Enthusiastic cheers from tens of thousands of people in this crucial swing state of Ohio. A landmark arms control treaty signed by President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev 3 decades ago is dead. The U.S. and Russia have both walked away from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF, as of today. Joining us now is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. She's at the State Department. Michelle, first of all, what was in this treaty?
Well, the INF treaty essentially banned an entire class of intermediate range missiles. And, Jeremy, it was really key to ending the Cold War nuclear arms race in Europe at the time.
And Secretary of State Pompeo released a statement today that blamed Russia. It said Russia is solely responsible for the demise of this treaty. Why does he say that? What did Russia do?
According to U.S. officials and NATO officials, by the way, Russia developed and deployed a missile that was banned under this treaty. U.S. officials have been raising concerns about this particular ground-based intermediate-range missile for a really long time since the Obama administration. And the Trump administration says it gave Russia every chance to come back into compliance with the INF, but that Russia made no effort. And, you know, this was the 6-month period of withdrawal. And today was the official day of the U.S. pulling out of it. Officials say the Russians have since deployed multiple battalions, that's how they put it, of this missile. And they say it's capable of reaching all of Western Europe.
And what does Russia say?
Well, at first, the Russians denied the U.S. allegations. Then they said that the missile that they had developed didn't have the range that the U.S. said it has. Today, it was just basically saying that it was a mistake for the U.S. to pull out. It accused the Trump administration of being intent on destroying all international agreements that don't suit them. But really, neither side seemed eager to keep this treaty and to keep the restrictions in place.
I want to listen here to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres talking about the end of the INF yesterday. Here he is.
I'm concerned about rising tensions between nuclear armed states. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF, is a landmark agreement that helps stabilize Europe and end the Cold War.
How real are the concerns, Michelle, that the INF has expired will lead to a new arms race between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, you know, Jeremy, the U.S. is already planning to test a new missile in the coming weeks that would have been prohibited under the treaty. U.S. officials say they're still years away from deploying such a missile. And the NATO Secretary General is insisting that no one wants an arms race. But I talked to former Senator Sam Nunn, who once led a bipartisan effort to safeguard former Soviet weapons. And he's really worried that we're entering into a period of nuclear instability. Those were the words that he used with me. He says there's really no trust between the U.S. and Russia, which is adding to this instability.
There's also another even bigger arms control treaty, the START treaty, that expires in 2021. Is that also in jeopardy?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the last one that has a cap on the nuclear programs between the U.S. and Russia. There's a big push to get the Trump administration and Russia to just extend that. The Trump administration so far is not making any promises, but we're going to hear a lot about that in the coming weeks and months.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joining us from the State Department. Michelle, thank you.
Sure thing.
Today, officials in Atlanta began adding context to prominent Confederate monuments across the city. New plaques at four local monuments acknowledge slavery and the legacy of racism and segregation after the Civil War. A new marker next to the 1911 Peace Monument in Piedmont Park says, "This monument should no longer stand as a memorial to white brotherhood. Rather, it should be seen as an artifact representing a shared history in which millions of Americans were denied civil and human rights." Georgia law says Confederate monuments cannot be removed. Many people in the state say the statues honor the state's heritage. But following the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August 2017, the city of Atlanta created a committee to make recommendations on the future of Confederate monuments and city street names that many see as celebrating a racist history. The population of wild boars is exploding across the world. Up to 10 million feral pigs live in Europe alone, and their reach is expanding into cities like Houston and Hong Kong, where the 400-pound boars root through trash and carry all kinds of nasty diseases. Bernard Warner has been on the hunt in Barcelona, and he wrote about it for The Guardian. Bernard, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, and wild boars becoming urban boars and now trashing cities around the world. What's going on? What's causing this?
This is a phenomenon that probably goes back to the early 80s or so. In Europe, where the boars are native species, the population is a little bit bigger, but there is the problem in the United States, particularly in the South. Basically, from Florida to California and most states in the Union have some boar population. So the fact that you may not see it in your particular neighborhood today does not mean that it will not be an issue in the next certain amount of years, depending on where you live in the United States.
But you write that in cities across Europe, Barcelona, Rome, Berlin, even places like Hong Kong, these animals are moving from the outskirts of cities into the cities and causing all sorts of problems. Why? What's causing this movement?
There's two phenomena to why we're seeing more boar-human clashes in places across much of the continental Europe. The boar are losing basically their habitat, and this is because of urbanization. At the same time that their natural habitat is dwindling, the cities are producing quite a bit of waste, and we are drawing the boars back in from the forest into the city, where they're fattening up on our food, on our trash. They're making a bit of a nuisance of themselves out on the streets as they encounter a new habitat for them, which is the city.
And you saw this firsthand. I know you spent some time prowling the dark alleys of Barcelona with scientists who were trying to catch these animals and then put them to sleep, draw their blood, and eventually euthanize them. What did you see on that night looking for these boars?
So we were in a part of the city which is the green hilly bit, which is somewhat forested area there. And these are places where people live. There are university complexes, old age homes. This is urban life here. Yeah. It just happens to be green and somewhat leafy. And what happens is the boars come down into the city. Usually at dusk, they antagonize dog walkers and joggers and things like that.
And they're nasty. I mean, you don't want to come across one of these things.
No, they're incredibly strong. Their bite is, they have quite large incisors that you definitely do not want to get on the wrong side of a boar. They're not really aggressive, but they have lost what the forest boar, the traditional forest boar, would recognize you and me as a predator and mm-hmm. would stay away. The problem with the city boars is that they see you and me as competition for food.
So what happened when you went on this
hunt? They're going to get close to us. So I arrived the first night in a park, and they had hoisted up a drop net trap. Imagine a 10-meter by 10-meter trap with four poles, and it had a central spring, and it just literally came crashing down with the swipe of an app. And there's these hellish squeals. Mm. I mean, it really was like a horror film. You know, these are the squeals of 11 captured pigs. They're not hurt. They're just startled and trapped. And the netting is black nylon. So the more they buck and struggle, the more they get wrapped around the netting. And the more they get wrapped around the netting, the more frantic they get.
So over the course of two nights, these scientists catch 29 boars in this neighborhood in Barcelona. They take the blood. They then euthanize them, as we said. But the blood tests come back with a surprising, or maybe not so surprising, result. These animals are infected with all sorts of diseases, salmonella, hepatitis E. What's the health risk of these animals as they move into the cities where people are?
These animals are not healthy. In choosing this habitat to live with us in a filthy city, eating our trash, it's transforming this animal. It's not the same animal of the forest. Some of them are diseases that we have as well. These are, you know, tuberculosis, hepatitis, influenza. They can make the jump to us humans, and they also can go to the boars. And this is what happens when you have a mixing of species in a single space, and it's not ecologically pure.
Tell us about another one of the diseases that these animals can carry. It's called African swine fever. It's incredibly dangerous to the food supply. Some European countries are even putting up hog-proof barriers along the border to keep infected pigs out. What role do these wild hogs play in spreading that?
African swine fever is highly contagious. It's nicknamed pig Ebola. It does not impact humans in any way. What happens is the farmyard pig can give it to the boar, and the boar can give it to the farmyard pig. And it's highly mortal as well. Those who come down with it, it's close to 100% death rate, and it's a really awful way to go.
And that would wipe out these farmyard pigs and devastate the farmers who make a living off of this and affect the food supply, it sounds like.
This is the problem, and this is why it's become a global geopolitical issue, because China's pork industry has been devastated by African swine fever. And the United States is freaked out about the idea that pork meat that could be contaminated with African swine fever could possibly enter the United States market. If it does, it would be devastating. It stays in there for months. If you cure it, you don't get rid of it. If you cook it, it doesn't get rid of it. The only way to do it is to cull these animals and then incinerate them. That's the only way to handle this outbreak. Every single country with a pork industry, which is basically every single country, has a similar view. They are desperate to keep any vector that might bring this disease into their market. They want to get rid of it, which is why they're coming up with these boar-proof fences and things like that, that frankly are not going to do the job.
So what is the answer? I mean, you went around Barcelona, scientists rounding up these animals and then euthanizing them, and that does not make animal rights activists very happy about this.
This is a really complicated issue, because this is a story that is going to be happening more and more. I mean, we're talking about boar and we're talking about African swine fever, but it's going to be a similar story with any wildlife that is now found a home in urban or suburban areas. In London, there's urban fox problems. In parts of Siberia, you have polar bears coming into the city dump. You know, in parts of the Western United States, you have bears that are coming in that now have a taste for human food. These are signs that we need to start thinking about the greater impact that we're having on the environment, even beyond where human development is, just into the hinterland, just into where the nature meets civilization.
Well, your reporting from these neighborhoods in Barcelona is vivid. We'll link to your story for The Guardian at hereandnow.org. We'll also put up some pictures of these wild boars that we've been talking about. Bernard Warner, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
And turns out wild hogs are not a nuisance to every city dweller who comes across them. The Wall Street Journal spoke to a man near Hong Kong who found a wild hog with an injured leg near his home. He helped nurse it back to health, named it Tommy, and now invites the pig to come down from the forest to eat dinner in his backyard.
Tommy! Oh! Come on!
Quite the dinner bell.
Baseball is a national pastime that goes back a long way. And during the summertime in Colorado, a traveling group of players takes things way back to the 1860s. Colorado Public Radio's Vic Vella recently caught up with players in the Denver area who are keeping the glory days of baseball alive.
You remember this old song from Terry Cashman called Talkin' Baseball, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke?
Talkin' baseball, Klazuski, Campanella, talkin' baseball, the man and Bobby Fella.
He just rattles off all these baseball legends who were known by super fun nicknames.
The Scooter, the Barber, and the Nuke, they knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
Well, there's a group of guys playing today who aren't as famous as the ones in that song, but they got great nicknames too, like Digger, Suds, and Texas Mike. And they travel around Colorado playing baseball with rules from an era long before Willie, Mickey, and the Duke played the game, long before rock and roll.
We'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, touting the manly sport of baseball.
It's the Colorado Vintage Baseball Association. It was formed in 1993, but the players take us back to the 1860s with the uniforms to match. At a game in Broomfield recently, players were wearing era-appropriate hats and long stockings with shirts embroidered with logos written in Old English-style lettering. Steven Scorpion Castellani is the league's commissioner. He's wearing knickers, a pillbox hat, and a uniform that features a cavalry-style bib on the front.
You'll find that every last one of us here on the field is actually a thespian in sorts. We do this because we love acting. The organization was actually founded by a group of Civil War reenactors who just basically got tired of pointing guns at one another.
Hey, Eagle Rabbit, keep going, baby!
Riker's dead!
The field they played on was pretty rough, with long grass and weeds popping out. But Castellani says there were no groundskeepers in 1860s baseball.
There were no groomed fields as you see today, with dirt base paths. There is no pitcher's mound or hurler's mound unless you happened to be standing on a gopher hill. That was the exception to that. The bags were usually made of potato sacks or some such thing filled with dirt. The home plate was just that. It was a plate, like a dinner plate.
Your lineup. Batting first, playing short scout, Roger Digger Haddix.
All right, Roger, huzzah!
On this particular day, Haddix was wearing the uniform of the 1869 Central City Stars team. They were in a battle against the Denver Blue Stockings. But I say battle with a grain of salt. They keep score in vintage baseball, but it's certainly not a super competitive league. Robert Mitchell, who goes by the name Buckeye and plays for the Blue Stockings, says the league is more about having fun and having respect for your opponent.
So you're acting as if you're in the 1860s. So you'll hear different language a little bit, people trying to be more gentlemanly, not charging the man, not arguing, disclosing whether you're really safe or out. Yeah, he got me. Okay.
There we go. Nice. Way to hit the gap, sir.
Back in those days, scoring was ridiculously high, and it was common for games to have a ton of errors. A lot of that had to do with the fact that they didn't play with gloves back then, and neither do players from today's Vintage Baseball Association. Here's Buckeye again.
Authentic to the period, people weren't very good at playing baseball, so there were a lot of errors. No gloves, no experience.
So when you fumble it here, it's exactly what happened back in the day.
Bingo.
The players also used terminology from back in the day. Chuck Knezovich, who goes by the nickname Suds, explains that in the 1860s, pitchers weren't called pitchers and catchers weren't called catchers.
You're a striker. You're not the batter anymore. The behind's the catcher. The pitcher's the hurler. You're a base tender.
Okay.
I mean, all those types of things.
So none of today's language really even existed back then.
Baseball was two words back then. So it was baseball.
And batting ninth and hurling, Suds!
So what makes these guys get dressed up in old uniforms every weekend, run around on rough playing surfaces, and catch baseballs with their bare hands? Well, Mike Texas Mike Michael says it's for the love of the game.
I tell everybody I'm 70 years old standing here talking to you. When I step on the field, I'm 12 again. And then when I step off the field, I'm a 70-year-old that feels like a 12-year-old's been running his body.
Our band of baseball is from bustling Denver City. We come to toss the ball around and sing to you our ditty.
The players' love for 1860s baseball is summed up with an old poem. We used no mattress on our hands, no cage on our face. We stood right up and caught the ball with courage and with grace.
Hurrah for the Barney Blue Stockings, champions of them all.
Hip hip,
huzzah!
Hip hip,
huzzah!
Hip hip, huzzah!
For Here and Now, I'm Vic Vella.
And we would like to thank our hosts here in Cincinnati, WVXU and Cincinnati Public Radio, including Rich Eisworth, Marianne Zalesnik, Don Danko, Josh Elstro, Chris Phelps, Ann Thompson, and Dave Shermer. Our Cincinnati coverage was produced by Chris Bentley. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.